Welcome to another podcast. I'm here once again with Ferdy. Here we are again. A lot has happened in the meantime, but perhaps we can start with the news of the past few days. Evergrande.
Yeah, thank you, Midas, for introducing me, and thanks again for having me over. Like you said, there's a lot to discuss. All kinds of things happening on the topics we discussed last time. And, well, the one you named is a very big one, the Evergrande, the second largest Chinese real estate firm, $300 billion in liabilities to all kinds of institutions and creditors. And it looks like it's going to default. So that's a historic default by all means, I think. And the way it's happening is a cause for concern for all global financial markets, as we already have seen yesterday on Monday, when the Dow and many stock exchanges slipped by like 3 percentage points. So yeah, it's a big topic, and it might have a big impact.
Yeah, so just to put it into perspective, $300 billion in debt for a private company, it's huge, right? I mean, it's about 1/3 of the entire Dutch GDP, for instance. It's a serious...
I don't think there has been a country or a firm before with that kind of debt that defaulted on such a big amount. I'm not sure what their estimate is at of total equity. They have a lot of unfinished and finished projects all around the world, of course. But, you know, they still have to find buyers for those things. So it's a huge number. And people are kind of guessing how big will the ripple effect of this default be through the Chinese economy, first of all, but also through the foreign investors on the global financial markets. So, yeah, it's a huge number, one single firm only. Who knows what the final tally will be if it takes other firms with it.
Yeah, Evergrande itself has a number of competitors, of course. So obviously investors will take a close look at their books as well. And this could mean a large ripple effect also for other property developing firms in emerging economies. I mean, yeah. All their books will have to be rechecked, right. I think. So there's no telling where it will end. Maybe the last time in 2007, the economic shock started in the US. Maybe this time it's going to come from China. Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And it's like you say, there's like the principal risk of evergreen defaulting on those loans and those creditors not getting back their money. And that has consequences of all kinds of its own, of course. And depending on how much exposure certain banks or institutions have, they will be either serious or, well, a heavy hit on, you know, the balance sheet, as it were. But the real interesting element is, like you say, what are investors going to do with other similar assets? Is this a wake-up call for everyone that the bubble is about to pop and it's time to get out now out of all these markets? And it's not only China, of course, but also here in Europe and all kinds of housing bubbles all over the world. And if that happens, I don't even want to make a guess on the trillions of dollars that will be wiped out in you know, stocks of those kinds and bonds of those kinds. It's a revaluation of debt, as it were, one that's been a long time coming, especially in this environment. Like we said last time, you know, the interest rate is not going up, the house prices are still booming, so there has to be a point in time where it stops. And in China, this seems to be the point in time where at least things are turning around for, well, the second biggest real estate manager in China.
Yeah, because in the previous weeks, the story seemed to be that we were going to put the brakes on the financial monetary expansion in the US, but also in Europe, with the ECB also giving some slight hawkish signals. Story is okay, the economy is going great again, so we can go back to normal.
I have to point out that, like I said, I disagree that the ECB really changed anything. It's because of two reasons. The first is there's two programs that the ECB has for the purchasing of debt and other assets from governments or some kinds of corporate parties. The first one has been running since around 2014, and it falls under a large-scale asset purchase program. The second one, it's the pandemic program. It's only been around since, I think, early 2020, like March 2020. And the announcement Thursday the 9th, I think, it was solely on scaling down the pandemic program.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So the first thing is that not all of the purchasing of debt is quitting. In fact, for the other program, they announced, well, we will continue doing so for as long as is necessary to maintain the symmetric inflation over the medium term. But they did announce that they intend to scale down pandemic programs starting in 2022 somewhere on March. But scaling down doesn't mean stopping. And the second thing is, scaling down or even stopping doesn't mean reverting the progress or the program. So over the years, so many euros have entered the market through these programs, and there's no intention that they will ever seriously reverse the program, such as the Federal Reserve has tried to do with the repo repurchase programs. There's been no initiative of that kind in Europe. And the interest rate is a fixed topic now, and people are no longer going to be surprised when it's as low as it is now in a year. So it's a little bit hawkish, of course, but it's really the bare minimum of what she could have done, of what Christine Lagarde could have announced to scale down, expensive policy.
Yeah, maybe I'm a bit too upbeat, but from my point of view, it was a little hawkish note, which is first since the pandemic began. And she did it without immediately spooking the market. So to me, I would say, okay, skillfully executed. Let's see what the next step is. But the first
that
small step...
True. Yeah, it remains to be seen how whether she will escalate this kind of policy. She has to tread carefully, of course. So it's understandable that they start with this and that they might choose to wind it down faster in the coming months, if the economy recovers as they seem to predict.
Yeah, I mean, but what is interesting is that the inflation, which I have been talking about since at least the spring, it has finally become mainstream. People are really noticing it.
Yeah.
So that is a good development, I think, in the sense that it is on the agenda, to fight the inflation.
Yeah, it has really jolted, financial experts, because even the official numbers have run up, above expectations and above the goal. But that was the goal. That was the goal before the symmetric inflation target was assumed. So the ECB reports in particular state that, everything is within range of a symmetric inflation target over the medium term. But that gives you so much leeway in a single year. So it's okay to overshoot by 2 or 3% maybe, and then you can still argue you did your job. But it's good to hear that more and more people are noticing, and it's very noticeable in all markets now. Food prices are also shooting up very fast. Gas prices are really sky high. It all starts with attention, with public attention to the problem. And that might steer the ECB in a different direction on that, because the inflation is unprecedented, or the highest in 20 years, I think, and it's cause to worry in such a crisis period. Yeah.
So the highest in 20 years, so pretty much the highest since we have the euro, then as well.
Yeah, for us it is. So it's also terra incognita, and where are we going with this, right?
Yeah. So this might be a good little bridge to get to the next topic, because the last time I saw you said you wanted to discuss shipping as well.
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
Well, shipping, and this is particularly weird that it hasn't been in the news as much. It has been on the occasion sometimes, you know, a short item about rising prices. But what we've pretty much seen, and I'm not capable of declaring it or explaining it in its full extent, I think, but I've been following a certain index which weighs all the routes from Shanghai to major ports in the world.
Okay.
And the shipping prices. It's called the Shanghai Freighter Index. And the expectation was that in 2020 it would rise really fast because there's a pressure on shipping because a lot of Western consumers shifted their spending from services to a lot of import goods.
Due to the pandemic.
Right, because services were unavailable and people started buying lots of things to build a new part of their house or design a kitchen or whatever. And most of those goods, of course, come from China. And they're all big physical goods that require, you know, a lot of shipping.
Big TV.
Big TVs and gardening tools or gym tools, you know, you name it. And if it's a durable good, there's a large chance it's coming from China. So there's been a lot of demand for shipping on one hand. On the other, shipping has been put into a chaotic state of affairs because of COVID. Because of course, in the start of the pandemic, you had those cruise ships, right? Sailing Corona nests, as it were, because everyone is so close and always in contact with each other.
Real horror stories of people trapped on the boat.
Exactly, and they can't get out. And, you know, on those shipping vessels, of course, the amount of people is a lot smaller. But the problem is practically the same. If there's a corona infection on board, there's a problem.
Yeah, it's very multinational. Ship. People need to travel in lots of different countries.
Yeah, and they need to get back to their countries, or they can't, or they need to get to the ship on time, or they can't. And that leads to so many problems logistically for shipping to be efficient. Well, and then there's also the hilarious event of the Suez Canal blockage, which, you know, disrupted the Suez route for like a week with untold effects on shipping. So all these things together have resulted in the shipping exchange, the index rising about 400% in about a year. So that's all the major ports, including Busan or the Tokyo port. So also for us less popular ports. If we look at the Europe Shanghai route, prices have nearly risen tenfold in the summer on the most popular part of the year. So if you consider those kind of things and the amount of spending we have on durable goods that require shipping, you can start to see where the inflation is coming from. It's coming from factors like shipping, which have risen through the roof and become totally inefficient industries, as it were. They're starting to push the price of everything up. All the things that you have to order or have to be shipped from somewhere are getting more and more expensive. So I think this is one of the major reasons that all around inflation on all durable goods is really occurring fast now, including food, for instance. It also needs a lot of shipping, and even though it might not all be shipped from Shanghai, it's all being pressured by the high prices there and the choice of a lot of shipping companies to divert their power there and their capacity to Shanghai in order to maximize profit. So it's just rising the prices on every market, I think.
So can you attribute these cost increases purely to the pandemic, or are there also some more structural causes to it?
Well, it's I'm sure there's also structural causes in terms of capacity of ports, for instance. No way to handle the demand that there is. But it's important to underline that the real booming of this problem, the real development, has happened under COVID. And I think that the necessity of all kinds of measures to contain corona spread, combined with, you know, the new kind of demand for all these durable goods, has been a very, very big factor and essential in, you know, just letting the prices hit the sky, as it were, because everyone wants those goods on time, but it's just not happening, and it's disrupting the entire supply chain, of course, not just shipping to the consumer, but also in the middle of the supply chain where we have to bring parts of a machine to a different factory. So yeah, it's costing time and money for all the parties.
Yeah, so in my upcoming book, I'm talking a lot about regionalization, that we are moving from a globalized world to a world which is more regional. And then I'm talking about reshoring, producing closer to the target market, but also nearshoring, that an area closer to the target market could become more important. And then also the whole shift in which China is trying with their Belt and Road Initiative to do more via rail. So I gather from what you're saying that these developments are not exactly related, but perhaps could have an augmenting effect on those processes which are already going on.
Yeah, definitely. And the Belt and Road is like a good example of how China, you know, has foreseen this problem occurring sometime in the future. And it's becoming more viable, of course, as the price of shipping goes up. It only needs to rise high enough for other means of transport to become the mainstream, because they're the cheapest option. So it's also for your idea of reshoring and bringing it closer to home. It will become viable once the shipping costs will become too much, or the costs of delays, you know, and late shipments arriving. Once that's at a point where you really can't handle it anymore, you'll have to find local suppliers. The real question is, to what extent is it possible to remain at our current level of economic production with that model? Because you might save on shipping, but you'll have to pay on a lot of other aspects, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. You will have a transformation in your economy where you cannot longer just be a service provider, but you need to have some production in-house as well. And I think that could also really at the one hand increase costs, so moderate profits, but could also increase wages because you need more employees in your target market as well.
Yeah, I think that's a direct bridge to another topic I wanted to talk about, which is the labor market. And also a point I wanted to make in connection with the reshoring. If we look at the current labor market, which has, you know, a record amount of job openings, but less people working than before, and that combined with the idea that we want to bring labor-intensive industries back here, as it were, in order to save on shipping and all kinds of other things, I'm not sure those two things are able to be reunited efficiently as it is now. So it's all kinds of low-skilled or medium-skilled labor, which is very intensive and which we, at least in Western Europe, aren't all too accustomed to do. So the question is, will the wages rise enough to attract the workers? How much wage increases can these industries really afford if they want to produce here? And it's probably not that much, at least until the consumer starts to appreciate the goods more once they're in, you know, low supply, and the prices start to rise. But then we'll see a, you know, remaking of the entire economy of what people deem important and what they don't.
Yeah, but it seems that here somehow the free market is not working, because the press is full of we cannot find any staff. But you would say supply and demand, okay, you just need to pay higher wages for you to get that stuff, you know. You need to accept that profits will be not as astronomically high as they have been in the last 20 years.
But what if, you make an estimate of what you would have to pay to really attract people, and you would just find out that that would bankrupt you, or that you would not be able to pay your monthly expenses? And I think that that's the point of the problem by now. In industries like restaurants and hotels, or like on the farm, seasonal work, you know, I think the people that were fired in this period realized the instability of their employment, and that they could have to be forced to stop at any time. A few months before, they wouldn't know at all what was going to happen, and 3 months later, they're at home. So these people might not be willing to return that easily. And I don't think that the average restaurant can afford to increase the wages of their staff by 20%. That would just kill them financially. So the hard truth seems to be that if we want to pay those people the wages that they want, it's not possible to open so many restaurants. And then it's just the bankruptcies which are inevitable if we want to root out those companies which can't afford the wage increases.
So, yeah, very sunny outlook from you.
Not very sunny, but it's time we be honest about that. And, combined with very cheap loans, which firms have been getting for so long, there's a reckoning waiting. And once one of these conditions, and now it's the labor, which is short, and once the loans become more expensive to refinance, it's got to end for a lot of companies which have been hanging on a thread until now.
Now, but that's very interesting that you mentioned that we need to face reality, because I feel that the entire political system has been stretching it all as much as possible, you know, pretending that everything is okay. For a while, they did that by raising taxes. And I think somewhere around the austerity measures in after the last crisis, they reached like the optimum. You know, they could not raise taxes any higher because the receipts would be less.
Yeah.
And then the decision was, okay, but if we cannot raise taxes, we can just print more money.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we are.
Pandora's box.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah,
it's just taxing people by different means, but
very indirectly and without their knowledge, as it were, that it is a form of tax.
Well, they're not being informed. The media is not doing anything in this regard.
It doesn't seem to be either within their interest or in their capacity to understand and relate it to everyday happenings. But that's a very, disturbing fact, considering how often the housing market is in the news.
Yeah.
And how little, central bank policy has been discussed in relation to that.
Monetary policy is seen as something which is not political, it's just a force of nature.
Right.
And if you raise the tax by 1%, then everyone is in an uproar.
Right, but in the streets.
Exactly. But if you print 1,000 billion euros, then you can just do that without any opposition.
Which is really weird, because I'm sure that if you hold a psychological experiment where you give someone 10 euros and then say, well, these are all the euros in the world, and then say, well, I'm giving your friend here 20 euros. What do you think about that? Then most people will say, well, I'd rather you not, right?
Because exactly,
that means
yeah.
my 10 euros is worth less. But in our system, because it's so unknown and so many people are unfamiliar with the entire idea of what a central bank is really doing every day, that it's just out of the picture, and we'd rather blame something else.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's true that the ECB is not under democratic control. But I do think you could do something. Yeah? So I have this crazy idea, if you're willing to hear me out.
Enlighten me.
Well, any EU member state could say, okay, I'm going to refinance the entire government debt at 3%. So I'm going to make sure that my pension fund gets a good return on their money. That's one. Part two, I'm sending a message to the rest of the EU, like, okay, these low interest rates are not possible anymore. And part three, you are forcing your government, but also the governments that come later, to be very austere. I mean, they need to cut spending, because now those interest payments are serious.
Yeah.
It's not free money anymore.
But I think it's just political suicide. If you introduce a 3% loan on your entire state debt, you have to pay that out of your budget every year.
Yes.
So what are you going to cut? And that's going to hurt. I'm not sure how big the impact would be on a country like the Netherlands, but I'm sure we're talking about billions a year.
Yeah, you need to not care about being reelected.
Right. Right. And people will elect themselves over rejecting, you know, your idea. Yeah, we're so proud that we're receiving loans with 0% interest, right? Or negative interest rate.
Yeah, it's free money.
It's free money, right? That's what the balance sheets also says. It's all free. But if you do it to 3%, like with many firms who have loans between 1% or 2% interest, if it would go to 3%, they would become insolvent and the debt payments would just kill them, just like it's killing Evergrande now. And I don't think, well, maybe a few member states would manage, but imagine Italy or something introducing such a law.
Yeah,
such,
there's a huge risk to both the member states and also to corporates who are reliant on these low interest rates. On the other hand, I mean, a continuation of the current policy, that's to me even scarier. It's even scarier because your wages are going down in real levels and all assets are going up. So we are creating like a new class society. I mean, everyone who has wealth will be rich indefinitely and everyone who doesn't
just
will
because
be...
somehow. Nothing really changes, but somehow it's become more valuable. And well, it's a direct result, of course, of the past 10 years of policy by the central bank.
I mean, we're slowly drifting into like something out of Charles Dickens, you know, like with a few really, most people extremely poor, and then some of the lucky guys can just live without working. I mean, there's a guy in the media last week, he put it really bluntly. He said like, okay, but I'd be much better off just owning two apartments than working.
Right. Like, yeah. Yeah, but those kinds of weird situations where economic, what we think would be logical economically, is no longer happening, and people are always just choosing the imagined returns of some investment. It doesn't matter if the investment is trash, like we're seeing with Evergrande now. It's just all about letting the money work for you, and that's been stimulating some very bad developments here all over the world. Incomes aren't going up, so it's very understandable that people want to gain income from other sources. Interest rates on banking accounts are zero or less, so of course people want to use their capital to gain returns somewhere else. Like I said, it's a direct result of the central bank's policy. Even those people that normally would never use a euro of their savings to invest because it's too risky.
Yeah.
Even they are continuously pushed to, you know, put it somewhere where it at least gets 2% or 3% return a year, because they have 50,000 in savings, but they don't get any interest.
Yeah.
And that's,
they are taxed though.
They are taxed. Well, they are taxed, so they are all paying to save, and that's, you know, intended. That's the intended effect of negative interest rates. That's what the ECB writes in their policy books. Like, we want to decrease the attractiveness of saving because we want people to invest and spend. But people have mostly invested, if they've moved at all, and not spend it. So the assets for real estate, for stocks, have just gone through the roof with so much money that wasn't supposed to be there, or wouldn't be there without the central bank's policy.
Yeah, so it's working as intended. And the question is it scarier if it stops working or if it continues to work?
Well,
and we don't know.
It's not 100% working as intended, because they wanted also to spend, you know, to have consumers spend more, because that would drive inflation and that would drive economic growth. Investing in assets doesn't drive up inflation per se. Of course, it helps. Increased housing prices also mean increased housing costs for most people. But if they had spent it, or rather if they had kept it on their savings account, they wouldn't have the risk. So now it's if it stops, and if those exchanges come down, and if those investments come down, if those second houses drop in value, it's all going to be going from private people's accounts, because they too have been pushed to invest everywhere. Those firms, of course, also have all kinds of investment and as little cash on hand as possible always. But it's also the little people who have been pushed away from saving up money to invest it in crypto or gold or real estate funds or whatever.
But is it possible that the central banks are operating on a fallacy? I mean, to me it seems I would spend far more money if I was secure about my pension fund, if my home payments were not that much. I mean, then I would be able to spend.
Right.
And they are making me, if anything, more insecure.
Right. That's what I also wrote in my thesis, and I think that it's what you say. It's a fallacy of the assumption they make. They say, well, you know, we are going to make saving less attractive by taking away the income from saving and taxing savings more and making investment in other things more appealing. But what has really happened is they have taken away a source of income for a lot of people, namely returns on savings. So, like you say, what you've actually done is you've decreased the stability of someone's financial situation. And as such, it's logical that they would increase their precautionary savings because they have less income, so they need a larger buffer for in case something bad happens because they don't earn as much money. But that seems, that's just, well, you know, economic logic. But they do not seem to accept this in their considerations. They keep hammering on the fact that they want people to spend and spend and spend and will just, you know, never increase the interest rate until they do. God damn it.
Yes. Until they do, yeah.
Until they do, but they're not going to.
Yeah, unless they're forced.
I mean, unless they're forced. Unless you tax it 100%, you know, people will spend it then.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And of course, there is a limit to how much monetary easing you can do. Eh? I mean, there is a certain point at which inflation is so extreme that it's not no longer credible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
But they did think that that point was 0%
for
a long time. Well, those have been proven wrong.
Yes.
But yes, it becomes incredibly spicy to lower it even further. I think people would start abusing that too much. Too many fraudulent loans.
Exactly, yeah. So we are entering times also politically, which are to me very confusing and also to many of the people around me. So just a while ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who is a member of the Social Democrat Party. And I was saying to him, okay, but we have reached the ultimate socialism now because the government has never been bigger than nowadays. And then he said to me, socialism? I mean, we are living in the ultimate liberal dream. I mean, inequality has never been higher than it is now. So
yeah.
There's nothing socialist about the current situation.
Right.
So I do have a very strong opinion. And I think I do have some ideas of solutions to the problems. But it's hard because people easily interpret something as either left-wing or right-wing. And you are like two different factions against each other. Well, in the end, you both want the same thing, right?
Yeah, I think especially with, you know, socialism, what it brings up for either left or right is a loaded concept always. While people can also just mean a form of welfare state, right? And there's nobody in Western Europe who rejects that. I think so. We're all socialists in that sense.
In a way, yeah, absolutely.
And left-right is a very unfair comparison to use when it comes to that, because it would almost imply to someone who sees right-wing people as not being socialists or not supporting those ideas, as someone who would deny any form of welfare or, you know, social provisions. But that's not true at all. I think people are actually pretty close in those discussions. The only question is who gets them and how easily can people get them. But both left and right agree that there must be some form of welfare state in order to help, you know, the truly needy. But I think it's a bit disconnected from the expansion of the government in the past 2 years, because it's been on such a personal level and such a direct connection on what you can and cannot do. Of course, expansion of the government in socialist or at least welfare state terms would mean, you know, basic income was introduced, and who knows, the times
are
so crazy.
But the government does have a very large percentage of the economy. They're just not spending it on fun stuff. I mean,
yeah, it's true. They're like 44% of all spending, but I think expansion of the government should always be seen. You know, how much has it changed compared to previous points in time? And I don't think that particular percentage has really gone up that much. Maybe it has in the past year, because of course the government subsidies have been under backing, as it were, you know, public spending and economic growth as it is. But I don't think that lowering that amount in itself would really be a reduction of socialism, as it were. Like, on what fields are you going to reduce public spending, would then be my question.
Well, I think you need to, if you are really being honest and you are really taking the pain of the economic downturn, then you need to cut somewhere. I mean, I think you cannot raise taxes anymore, so you need to cut. Or you stop printing money. But as we have discussed, I mean, the printing of money is also finite, so you need to cut somewhere. And what I'm seeing is the opposite. We're not going to cut. We're going to be increasingly ambitious. We have the.
Yeah.
We're going to get rid of all fossil fuels.
Yeah.
You know. So I mean, it's.
Yeah, there seems to be no plans for.
No credible plans.
Involvement.
No credible plans. No.
In these economic sectors. Yeah, that's true, and it's probably going up if it's going anywhere, that number, but. A lot of people don't really see that, I think, as a strong government involvement. Sure, they subsidize the hell out of electric vehicles or whatever.
Yeah.
But people see that as a marginal development.
Yeah, but factually, it's not marginal.
It's not marginal, but they think, well, it's only socialist if they're building the Teslas, you know?
Yeah.
If they own the factories. But of course, it's much more complex than that, and you can help your own government or your own firms in so many ways as a government.
Yeah, because just to tell you something about my experience, I used to be left wing about 10 years ago, and then left wing government started to bail out a bank, and then I was like, huh? So why should I be left wing if they are just going to use my tax money to bail out banks? So then I became right wing. And pretty much around today, last week, I decided to leave the right-wing party as well, because the right-wing party was introducing Eurobonds, was doing nothing about the monetary expansion, and has let the state debt balloon up to unforeseen heights.
It seems almost like nobody wants to face the consequences of finance as it is.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be the one to introduce the austerity this time, even though last time that our country did it, it was not even that unpopular, and people really understood.
It was the right decision.
But I don't think people are willing to throw themselves under the bus right now, especially in the Euro perspective. They don't want to be the one country that causes serious problems for the Euro as it is. Mark Rutte sometimes tries to push back, you know, but you know it's always a very limited showman attempt to show, well, you know, I don't totally agree, but
in the end.
We're gonna do it your way.
We're gonna do it anyway.
Yeah. And most people, I don't think, have the balls as it is, or as it were, to stand up to those kind of things. Same with the monetary policy. They don't want to be the one that says the party ends here, and the booze is out, and it's time to drink some water now. Because, it's not going to make you any friends, or well, very few friends.
Yeah, well, the good news is that we can criticize what is happening, huh? So that's the good news. I think we can also think, not completely, but we can think of alternatives. But we just need to think on how can we make those alternatives credible, and how can we make them visceral to let really people feel like, oh yeah, this is a good idea.
Yeah,
that's a big challenge, which I think about a lot.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, especially the last part, of course, because you need belief in order to really enact change on that kind of level. And I think there's too many people who are also, you know, consumers and voters who are too hesitant to embrace revolution on that sphere, because in any case, heads will roll, and it we don't know whose heads exactly, but people will always fear it's them, and people who do have a house that has increased in price twofold, you know, in the past 10 years.
A lot of
are
people
are going to resist real measures that might decrease their house value?
Yeah, a lot of people are okay with stability, because they are either scared or they have a lot to lose. So,
change doesn't always mean progress for everyone.
No, that's
and
true.
In this case, it might be fair, you know, even for the average homeowner who is in equity so much better off than you know, people who rent, to take a step down. But of course, the reaction there will be, why my money and not, you know, the 1% and the billionaires and stuff, go get it from them. So if we want to really be serious about tackling inflation and reducing the expense of monetary policy, we're gonna have to have a good talk with each other about what that would mean for a lot of people here, in order to help the others. Will they be willing? I don't know. Not in my backyard is what they say. It's the same with windmills or solar panels or budgetary cuts.
Yeah.
Never something that affects me, please.
Yeah.
That's going to be the name of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's the end. Eh? Just we continue on until it becomes impossible to maintain. I mean, that's
And then suddenly we're in like a Blade Runner-esque world, and we're walking around depressed in the rain.
Yeah, or the Weimar Republic, to take a historic example. I mean,
yeah, also very entertaining and spontaneous. Yeah, but I guess the real truth is nobody knows. And even people in power don't seem to really have an idea.
No, but we continue to criticize it, and we continue to come up with new ideas.
Yeah.
So yeah, just keep on fighting the good fight, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it's a unique situation, so that should be interesting to those who are interested. And there's lots of opportunities to learn all kinds of things about how people react to all kinds of weird policy developments. So it's an interesting time, and I'm sure that there's never been as much potential for change as now. The only question is, can we make the change that we want happen? And for most people, that change is very different than what I think also you have in mind.
Yeah, so if you're listening right now, just enjoy the ride. You know?
Sit back, light one up, enjoy the ride, you know, all things come to an end.
Take a cold beer and
with the boys.
With the boys, yeah. Enjoy.
Yeah.
Right, so I think we discussed a lot of the topics which we wrote down. Anything else you want to discuss?
Well, we might talk a little bit. I think it's a very interesting development. The AUKUS treatment, the Australia, United Kingdom, US defense treaty.
Very
interesting how that seems to come out of nowhere. And now France is pissed off beyond measure. And I think it's very signifying of how loose the alliances are getting, and how multipolar the world is becoming.
Yeah, I actually asked my friends today for some input on that, because I don't fully understand it myself, but they are like this Navy nerds, you know? So they had some sort of talk about how France will probably be compensated somehow, but I didn't really understand it.
Well, that's part of the row, is that Australia had an outstanding order with France for nuclear submarines amounting to, I think, about $30 billion.
Serious?
But they
almost one tenth of the outstanding debt of.
Right. Imagine the nuclear submarines you could purchase with that money, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You could conquer the Pacific.
Yeah.
But they seem to have scrapped that order and are now purchasing from the U.S. And France is just furious, and they recalled their ambassadors, which is very unique in these kinds of relationships. And today they announced that France has vetoed the EU-Australia free trade agreement.
Of course, linking everything. Eh? That's,
exactly. For us Dutch people, it's like, well,
thanks.
I'm not sure I consent to this move, and whether it's in my interest. You know, at this point, the EU is just a play ball of France and Germany politically. They're pestering the UK, you know, and now they're using it to attack politically Australia. It's a very interesting development. Also, considering the unrest in the Pacific, you know, with China and India and Australia and Japan, you know. It's not heating up very fast, but it's definitely not cooled down. So this Pacific-focused partnership is very interesting. It also excludes New Zealand somehow, because they feel that New Zealand's ties with China are too good.
Okay.
And
yeah.
New Zealand has signaled that they don't want to spy anymore on China for their allies.
New Zealand doesn't really have a military to speak of, so that's
right. They have some strategic ports, but no, sizable military. But it's a very interesting development comparing to the world, you know, 10-20 years ago, where it seemed to be, after the Soviet Union fell, a unipolar world with the US and its allies against the rest. But now it's just, it seems to be a free-for-all more and more, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, I think the relationship between Australia and the US has been strong for a long time. But what I'm also interested in is to see how are the ASEAN countries and India as well going to try to walk the tightrope between China and the US.
Well, India, for one, has signed defense treaties with Australia and Japan in the recent months and the past year.
But they're also part of the Shanghai cooperation.
Right, it's take the best of both worlds.
Exactly.
Right?
So
see how long that works out for you. So yeah, it's a very interesting region, and this just adds fuel to the fire, I think. Definitely something to give attention to in the coming
The name of the game in the Pacific, I believe, is who can deny access to the shipping lanes.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can deny access to the shipping lanes through your opponents,
who has the best missiles?
Exactly,
anti-ship missiles.
Who has the best missiles, the best carriers, the best nuclear submarines?
Yeah, it's not about occupying certain ports or strategic places. It's about denying, transport and commerce to the enemy. So the bad thing about that is that it's not very hard for China to be good at that. It's a lot harder to build defensive capabilities than it is to build offensive capabilities. If you shoot 100 missiles, you can have a very advanced defense system, but it's gonna have a problem, right? So I think the powers are pretty evenly matched by now.
Yeah, let's hope it stays evenly matched, right? I mean, that's the best guarantee for stability that you have.
Let's at least hope that China thinks they're evenly matched, and let's hope that they don't do anything funny.
Yeah, well, let's see how China gets out of their economic crisis, because this Evergrande thing is going to have a lot of impact on them. And also their internal divisions are extreme. Their housing market is also extreme. I read last week that in Shenzhen, the price of an apartment is 43 times the annual wage. I mean, in Holland, it's like 10 times, and that's already very crazy.
Yeah.
But imagine it's 43 times over there.
Good luck saving up.
Good luck keeping the population happy and keeping your social contract working over there. So.
No, you're right. China has a lot of domestic problems as well. So they probably won't risk having a foreign affair, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a lot of talk about being like in a competition with China, but I think it's far better for all of us if China stays stable and we stay stable as well. I think we have a lot more shared interests than dividing interests.
For sure. But we do have to, you know, stand up to China where it encroaches on us, even if it's for shipping lanes where they build military outposts in waters that are not recognized as being theirs, or in shady commerce practice and a lack of regulation and safety problems in products and stuff like that, and financial weirdness such as the Evergrande that has happened with so many shadow banks and fake creditors pouring money into stocks that just get inflated to hell. So China has its problems, we have our problems, but I'm sure we can help each other. They're not our ally though, they're a contender,
that much is sure. Yeah,
economically, culturally, on a worldwide setting, they want to get more influence than us. That's just a fact, so we have to keep that in mind.
And they have a very interesting and innovative regime,
right?
With the social credit score, with the facial recognition. I mean, that's that is also a very scary picture. I mean, any dystopia that we can come up with, it's already there in China. So.
And they never announced the pace that they're going to do things. So in the past 6 months, they've also been introducing all kinds of social change, like children being limited to 40 minutes of gaming time per day, which is super absurd. If you think about putting those measures in place here.
Yeah.
Although, well, since COVID, that's become more realistic of an option because, like you say, greater government involvement for me has been in that sphere of activity, the personal space. What will you do with your time?
Absolutely. And that has a financial component as well, of course. But yeah, there's a lot of calls also in Europe, in the Netherlands, that, for example, people shouldn't eat that much meat, so we should make it more expensive to buy meat. So they're going a little bit in that direction, but let's hope we can
let's hope we can push it away from that direction. I want my meat.
All right, so a lot to discuss. Any closing remarks?
Not for me, just I hope everyone enjoyed the summer, and good luck in the coming months. It will be tough on all of us, I think.
It's gonna be interesting, it's gonna be a scary Halloween, but let's enjoy it, and stay sane, everybody, and I will see you next time. Thank you very much.